Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this week's episode of the Bombercast. It is an off-season Bombercast, obviously, because sadly, despite it being preliminary final weekend, Essendon did not make it. That would, of course, mean they'd had to win a final, which is something that's eluded them for a lot longer than we're going to mention tonight. But I'm your host, as always, Bonser34. The Grizz is not sitting with me tonight. Instead, I'm sitting with Essendon VFLW President Katie Leo. Katie, how are you?
I am very good. Thank you very much for having me. I will correct you straight away, though. I am the ex-Essendon VFLW president.
Sorry. Yes.
But I'm an ex of a lot of things, which I think we'll jump into.
Yes, you've certainly done a lot in your time in football, and we'll jump straight in. So for those that don't remember, you obviously served on the board for a number of years before focusing your efforts at the VFLW. Let's go back to the start, because joining the board, you joined at a fairly tumultuous time. Obviously, being an Essendon fan is part of the reason for joining, but if I'm not mistaken, you joined at the time where there was a little unrest between who was going to be coach, what was going to happen off the field, the players. What made you want to jump into that storm that was happening at the club?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking. So it was a very long time ago. In fact, it was I think nearly 11 years ago. Around this time of the year. You're absolutely right. It was the end of 2014. We were going through some stuff at the time. a few little things. And one of the things, there were a couple of things that kind of prompted me to throw my hat in the ring, and it was a really strange time. I was actually living in Sydney at the time, so I was a little bit out of the Melbourne bubble at the time, but I had gained quite a great group of friends on Twitter. So we were the Bomber family. We obviously were whatever at Tacos. There was a whole lot of things that the fans were going through, or all of us together were going through at the time. And then you're absolutely right. There was some real talk around who was going to continue to be our coach and who wasn't. And at the time, I felt incredibly strongly that the person that should lead our football club was the person that had already been leading our club, which was obviously the great James Hird. And I had kind of joked about the possibility of going and trying to bridge the gap between what I saw was a really big divide between the board of the Essendon Football Club and the kind of rank and file membership and supporter base of the football club. And I received some kind of messages of support, shall I say, from a bunch of people on Twitter and a few other platforms that kind of buoyed my confidence that maybe I could make a difference. And very strangely, once I decided to nominate myself and another member, Paul Cousins, both very kind of like from the ranks people, we actually joined together. A few members supported us and helped us with some connections into the media. And yeah, we managed to win, and I won my seat on the board for 2015.
So I was going to mention Paul, because you're right. You and Paul were very much rank and file members when you came along, and that's not taking anything away from you, obviously, because you're very successful in other fields. But in terms of joining the board, up until that point, the Essendon board had been, to me, a very closed institution, and possibly still is a little bit now with how I think they manoeuvre people onto the board, but with ex-players. So that was going to be my next question. So the next time around, obviously, Sean Wellman ran alongside you and Paul, and he won the seat next to you the next election. But it was really interesting to me that Sean himself reached out via social media, which I don't think I'd seen from any candidate before you and Paul. Do you think that you and Paul changed the way that the club sort of approached these elections? Because all of a sudden they had two members who'd gone out to the rank and file and then won votes that the club had probably not considered previously, and then Sean did the exact same thing, to win his seat. So do you think you potentially have changed the way the club approaches these things?
Yeah, look, honestly, I'm not going to be humble about this. We absolutely did. I see it to this day when people want to get elected, they are, whether they like it or not, and no matter their profile, are kind of forced to come and actually talk to the members. And I think one of the things that I held really dearly when I was on the board, I was lucky enough to be re-elected for a second term before I decided to stand down. I felt incredibly strongly the whole time, and still do to this day, that the heart and soul of this football club is the membership base. And if you are not talking to them and listening to them, even some of the most, what would be the term that I would use, most passionate of our fans, you're really doing the club a disservice, because without the membership base, the club doesn't exist. So it's really interesting to me to see the officials or the hopefuls that want to get onto the board jump onto, you know, your kind of Twitters or your forums and try to have that dialogue. And I always find it really funny when it doesn't go well, because it just shows how out of kind of whack it is for them to be actually having those conversations, certainly in a digital space with you know, your average member.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, poor Sean, to some of our listeners and Katie, our listeners were very passionate, talking about the Big Footy board members at the time, were very passionate about you and Paul as well. I'm not sure if you realised you had that support on that forum, but Sean did try and talk to a few of them on Facebook, and it didn't go so well for him. So I did feel a little bit sympathetic for him at the time, because as he, again, had done nothing wrong. It was just that he ran into a fairly hardcore Paul and Katie support base. But yeah, Let's talk about your time on the board. So obviously, James came back and was coach, and I was actually at the Corruption Medal in 2014, where I went away from that night thinking Bomber Thompson had the job, to be honest, because it sounded like he was accepting the job, which I was surprised about. The thing that's probably surprised me the most about that was how angry a lot of people in the room were about that. I don't think the club really expected the backlash. So obviously, James came back and battled away again for a year, and then, you know, unfortunately, things happened, and he stepped down. Where did you see the club going after that? So obviously we went with Woosh as our coach, but 2016 must have been a really tough time as a board member, let alone what everyone was going through on field.
Yeah, look, it's really hard to explain the emotional roller coaster of those first 2 years of being on that board, because in my very first month in that January on that board, I think it was in January. Oh, I hope I've got that date right. We got the not guilty verdict from the AFL. And I have this amazing photo in my phone that will live forever of myself and Paul Little, you know, smiling and holding beers in the boardroom at the football club, incredibly ecstatic that we got what we thought was a really fair outcome. And then you fast forward to 12 months later where we did get that guilty verdict, and it was dreadful. It was the most disheartening day. And obviously John Westwell Bush was already appointed as our coach at that point, because James had decided to stand down, or to resign, I should say. And, you know, we went out to find, because we knew that the court case was still kind of hanging over our heads with WADA, we went out to find a really kind of senior coach that really kind of put his players at the forefront. We actually also went out and got Bluey McKenna for that exact reason as well.
Yeah.
And I do remember, and then again, another ingrained memory at, you know, some early hour, 8:30 a.m. or just after the verdict came down, I went downstairs into the old Bomber Cafe to get a coffee, and Woosh just happened to be walking out of the cafe at the time. And I said to him, "Well, welcome to the football club." And he said, "You know what? We just pick our heads up and we just keep going." And I thought, okay, well, we've found the right guy here. This is the guy for us.
Yeah, it would have been really tough on Woosh when that happened, because, I mean, he went into the job knowing it was a possibility, but he had his entire club list just ripped out from underneath him, and he went from probably what he thought was going to be a relatively competitive 2016 to a year that really was just, he was pushing it uphill from the start. So he really did handle himself, I thought, with grace and class throughout that early part of his tenure.
He absolutely did. And I think, you know, if I can look back on it in that year in hindsight now, from a support, like being just a supporter, what a fun year. I mean, not fun. We only won 3 games, but those games meant so much. I remember when we beat Carlton at the end of the year.
That was fantastic.
And I burst into tears at the end of the game, and it wasn't from anything other than joy and pride and the feeling of the crowd and how much it meant to the players and the club itself. I don't know if you remember, but like the whole club ended up on the MCG.
Yes,
it was
yes.
just, it was scenes, right? It was like we'd won a grand final. But I also, if I think back to that year, and this is my own opinion, I would never kind of suggest that this is from anyone else's opinion, but I do wonder whether it gave Warsh a real opportunity to kind of test out the young kids, push in a new, what he wanted them to play like, a new style without kind of the senior players there, and really kind of set up that following year for when the players came back. But also, he also had the huge challenge of then having a bunch of players who may have been, and with all of the respect in the world and every right to be, pretty angry. And so having the right person to kind of get them back was just super important.
Yeah. Well, for me, 2016, the one that sticks with me, Katie, is when we did the walk to the G against Melbourne. Oh, and then and then we turned up and won. It was I remember watching the replay, Jason Dunstall saying it wasn't meant to be like this. They weren't meant to be able to do this. They were meant to be getting beaten by 100 points every week, because Melbourne had beaten GWS the week before. So I remember, I think we kicked the first couple of goals and we're all in the stands screaming, blow the siren, blow the siren. And then you're right, because you don't expect the victories, they become even more sweeter, and you can handle the losses because you understand there's a reason for it other than, oh, well, we're just a bad football club. It's, you know, there's a reason why it happened. And it did accelerate, I think, the careers, of, especially Zach Merritt. So I'm not sure. I think you're right. I don't know how much time in the midfield Zach would have got that year, but he really stood up and announced himself, I thought, during that 2016 season.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. It's actually probably ruined me, to be honest, because in my family, it's my mum and I who are the mad football fans. We go to the football together every week. We've got reserve seats. And I now am the most pessimistic football fan. I will walk into any game and be like, yeah, we're probably going to lose this. And she's quite optimistic all the time. And I think it's because I know how much it hurts when you expect to win and you lose, but yeah. I also know how much joy it brings me when I expect to lose and we do sneak a win like that Giants game this year in the middle of the season. It just feels great.
Yeah, I do want to just touch back on what you said about the players justifiably being angry and potentially not coming back. We actually managed to re-sign nearly all the players back that got suspended, apart from a couple, obviously, that got delisted and were probably in line to be delisted before that anyway. But I think we got nearly everyone we wanted back except for Michael Hibbert, who obviously went to Melbourne. And that time to me as an Essendon fan was a fun time, because we'd heard from the media that Michael Hurley was gone, Cale Hooker was gone, Dyson Heppel was leaving, and then all of a sudden these guys came back. And I actually think Damien Barrett blocked me on Twitter at one stage because I asked him how his list of Essendon players leaving was going. So I don't think Damien appreciated me being a bit of a smart ass to him. But from a board, from your side on the inside, how close were we to losing some of those players? Or do you think that they were always going to come back and have another crack?
The mass exodus.
Yes, exodus.
If I'm really honest, I'm not privy to that information. So like when you're on the board, you're honestly not that privy to that kind of information. It's a very operational piece of information. But what I will say is that I think that the relationships that the admin and the football department built with those players and continue to probably have with those players played the biggest role in why they all decided to return to that football club. And obviously their relationships with themselves, I think they're, you know, trauma is bonding. And so I think what that being suspended is just an awful scenario for an athlete whose, you know, natural career can be an average of 6 years.
Yep.
And so I think between the work that the club did, and I know, you know, I was certainly involved in what I thought was a really good way of retaining players, whether they be from that group or just, you know, our other players, which is that I still firmly believe that if the parents and the girlfriend or the wife or the family or the siblings love the football club and feel involved with the football club, then chances are the player will be happy as well. And so I know we did a lot of work in those years, 2015, 2016, 2017, particularly, to really wrap our arms around the whole wider family of that playing group. And I know for sure that that has had some really positive impact.
So we'll move away from the drug saga. It was such a big part of your time on the board, but it's not the only thing you were part of on the board. Is there something other than that time that you really strongly remember or really proud of your involvement with on the board during your tenure?
Yeah, I think like the first thing that comes to mind when you ask me that is when the same-sex marriage referendum happened. And, you know, there was this question of whether clubs should or would put any kind of messaging out. And that's obviously, you know, like it's a really tough one, right? Because you never want to alienate people and you don't want to make people feel like they are not wanted in the space, but that works both ways.
You have to be careful about the whole, the crowd that always cry, don't combine sport and politics. Although those that cry that, you tend to cry when it's one way, I think.
Yeah, and I think also too, like that, it's so intrinsically linked. It's like, you know, we can talk about things like representation in football, and like some people might suggest that's a political messaging, but actually, no, you can only be what you can see, and like have a look at, you know, Alir Alir and what he is doing in football, or have a look at, you know, I don't know, I can't think of anyone else right now, but Paul Waller is a perfect example. You know, these people from different backgrounds or from different sexualities or whatever that might be are really important. Anyway, I sidetrack. We saw a couple of the other clubs release statements, one particular football club who I am not a fan of. And if you go back and look at any of my social media, it would be pretty easy to find out which club I'm referring to, released a pretty watery statement where it was like, we're not really saying anything. You guys choose what you want to choose. And we had a board meeting, and I basically went into that board meeting thinking I was going to have to fight. I was going to have to stand on the table with rainbow flags to really like support our Purple Bombers, which is our LGBTIQA plus coterie, but also just like anyone that maybe is LGBTIQA in the football community that, you know, and obviously now that we have women's footy, there's like a lot of very confident and out LGBTIQA plus people. But I really thought I was going to have to fight, and I didn't. They said, should we put a statement out? Here's one that we've prepared. And every single person around the boardroom went, yeah, we should release that. And it was, I think, a really beautiful statement. It said that the football club and the people within the football club would support the same-sex marriage, but they also said that we understood that people have different opinions. And I think that, for me, that community aspect of football is what I think is where the magic happens in football. I think being able to affect your community and people's lives, I think, is obviously secondary to winning grand finals, because we all want to win grand final.
Yep.
But it definitely, if you get the community and the family right, that all leads to success.
Yeah, and community engagement's not a new concept to football clubs, because this is where they all started, isn't it, really? I mean, they were all community clubs to begin with. So I've always been amazed when people talk about, well, you can't have politics in sport, or you can't do this in sport, because it's where they started. This is the livelihood of where they are. And I think they're a very important part of our community sporting clubs, not just the AFL clubs, clubs all around the region. I mean, especially if you think country Victoria, a lot of these clubs are the town. And so I'm a big believer of community engagement when it comes to football clubs, and I think that's something that Essendon does really well.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. I think there's more that the club could be doing, if I'm really honest. But the community of a football club is the lifeblood. Like, there is a reason that you have 25-year volunteers that are still down at the football club every training session helping the players get their equipment out. There's a reason why you have a cheer squad that turns up every single home game and away game and put their time in on a Thursday night to make the banner. And this is the kind of the blood that runs through the veins you know, and I, as I said, I do think that there's more that clubs can do, but I think also there is a time restriction on what you can do with the players. And unfortunately, what most people want is the players' time. Yep. So it is, it does mean that the club has to be careful with what, you know, how they spread their players' time. But yeah, I think, I agree with you. I think that without the community, we're all nothing.
It's really interesting you mentioned the players' time, because we spoke with Gary O'Donnell earlier this year, and he mentioned that he thought he would have been really good as a player now, because he would be able to have been prepared a lot more meticulously than what he was back then. He said he was really hard trained, so he thinks he would have loved the modern science side of things. But he said the amount of just time now that's consuming the players' lives, he thinks he probably would have found that fairly difficult, because it certainly has changed from his time in the 80s and the 90s to now, in that it's a job that never stops for the players, is it, really?
Yeah. I used to talk about when I very first went onto the board, I wanted to understand how we were developing the players outside of football. One of my concerns is that, and you see it quite a bit, that like footballers go through the AFL system, they get probably earmarked when they're 16, they get drafted when they're 18. It's a full-time job from the minute they're drafted, because it is, it's elite sport. And, you know, one of the things that I always really admired about the kind of Kevin Sheedy years is that they all had like university, or they were doing a trade, or they were using the networks within the football club to buy all the properties in Essendon. And so when I came on to the board, I was really interested to understand where the club was at that point with that development side of things. And I think you'll find the kind of, I don't know how to use my words properly here, but the kind of the more motivated and more ambitious players will make sure that they're doing something outside of football that does take their mind off the stress and anxiety and emotion of football. I suspect that if you have a player that is 24/7 football, I don't know what it must be. I'm not an elite athlete, but I know what it's like to be a professional. And if I thought about my job 24/7, 24 hours a day, I probably would burn out pretty quickly.
Yeah. I do want to ask you another question about the football club. And we talked about the transition. We spoke about the transition just then from what it used to be to now. How at a historical club like Essendon, which is, it's very old and has its roots and it dates back, and how do you manage to bring a club like that into the modern era? So your experience of the board around same-sex marriage vote was very positive, and that's very exciting, I think, as a football club, that we were so able to be so on the front foot for that. But there's a lot of tradition and history, and a lot of people, I think, become very attached to it. So as a football club, we do have to remain relevant. So how do you manage that at a club like Essendon?
Oh, that is an incredibly hard question to answer. I think one thing that you can't do is lose sight of what built this football club and what made it great. But what is a challenge for the club is to harness that into a positive energy rather than a negative one. So I think I'm choosing my words very carefully here, but, you know, there is this element that, you know, you talk to the old players and they'll laugh and talk to you about the brown paper bags that used to turn up in their locker room. And, you know, like the shenanigans of the 80s and the 90s, and that is great. And that is, again, it's something that our club is built on. But that becomes an issue in modern day football when you've got highly skilled coaches who are talking to footballers and teaching them structures. And then you might have people external to that circle that are giving them different information or suggesting things to them. And I think it's a real balancing act of ensuring that you harness people's energy for good and push them in a direction that is really positive and helps grow the football club, and try to prevent it from maybe clouding the players or tying up their time or taking away from what they're meant to focus on.
Yeah. It's interesting, Katie, because I think, yes, the football club's going through a transition right now in itself, in that it appears like Adrian Dodoro is stepping away, and he's been there for many years. And obviously Kevin Sheedy stepped down from the board, or was announced he will step down from the boards, and he's been there for many years. It does feel like we've reached a new era. Does it feel like that to you? It's probably harsh to say that we're stuck in the past because of Adrian and Kevin, because it's not just because of them. There has been other times, I think, where the club's looked backwards and not forwards. But do you think now under Brad Scott that we are in a new era and starting with a clean slate, so to speak?
Yeah, I do. I think what this current board has done, and I said this to them, so I have no issue saying that publicly, while some of their execution early on was a bit shaky, I think what they did and what they have done and where they are taking this football club is a new place, and I think it's the right place. I think the appointment of Craig Vozzo is fantastic. He is a football guy, but is also a commercial guy. And I think I spoke to him on the weekend and he talked to me about culture and I in the football department. And I said to him, you know, that is all I want to hear constantly. I just want to hear about culture. I think the appointment of Brad Scott was fantastic. And I look, it'll remain to be seen where his coaching takes us. He took North Melbourne, you know, pretty far into the finals with their list. And so I have no doubt that he is a good coach and will take us a long way. But I think where he shines is that he is a football guy that then went and worked at the AFL and then came back to a club. He has experience on both sides. He's also, and I haven't met Brad Scott, so this is just my opinions from the outside looking in. He seems like the kind of guy that knows what he wants and will not let anybody get in his way. And to me, that is what you want in a senior coach. I think there's been times where maybe there were too many voices in the coach's box. And I think that I hope that that is not I hope that he listens to his coaches, but I hope that Brad Scott knows what he is doing and he is driving it.
Yeah, I think that's a great shout out. It has felt like there's been too many voices in the coach's box at the time. And I haven't met Brad, but I find it hard to believe he'd not run a fairly tight ship, seeing how well he worked at North Melbourne. But let's move back to talking about you, because that's why we're here. You became the inaugural VFLW president, if I'm not mistaken.
Sorry.
How did you land that? Well, how did that role come about?
It sounds a lot fancier than it actually was in the beginning. It was when I was still on the board. We put a application in for an AFLW license because we did decide as a board to not put one in the first round for financial reasons. We were still going through, you know, the remnants of the 2012 program.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made a decision that we didn't think that we were in an inappropriate place to bid the first time, but we bid the second time. Our bid was fantastic. We got feedback that it was the best bid that went in, but in the first round they promised, well, they kind of basically didn't promise, but they kind of said to the clubs that bid in the first round, you'll get a team in the second round. So we missed out in the second round, and I remember sending Xavier Campbell an email when he emailed us to tell us that we'd missed out. I said, well, let's go build the best VFLW program and become a football factory for the AFLW, and he said, damn straight. And so I put my hand up to be the VFLW president to provide a couple of things, support, particularly in the earlier days, because we didn't get crowds at the VFLW. In fact, we didn't really get crowds at the VFLW until we started winning. and because it's always the way. And also because we wanted somebody, you know, from the board to kind of be involved and kind of just be the eyes and ears on the ground. And luckily we had a fantastic program run by really great leaders in the VFLW, and I was just incredibly lucky to be involved with them and support them. And then, you know, we built a mentor program within, so Melissa Green led it, but we built a mentor program within the VFLW to go learn digital marketing, because VFW girls, they got paid nothing to come and play, but we wanted to provide them a development opportunity outside of football. And so we taught them digital marketing. We had a bunch of people run a training program. And then I got really involved with the, just like relationship wise, with the ops manager and the senior coach. And yeah, we created this really great environment for our players to thrive. And that was proof in the pudding in the end.
Yeah. And obviously the highlight, I suppose, of your time would have been the premiership in 2022.
Nothing better.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, it's a fallback to me when people were sending me the memes the other day of the 20-year anniversary. And, you know, we actually won a flag two years ago. It's, you know, it's not as long as you think. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people counted it as ending the 20-year streak, but it's certainly something I tried to use the other day.
I was reminded recently, and I went back and had a look, that if you go back to my Twitter account in 2022 on the night that we won the grand final, I, after possibly just a couple of champagnes, might have been tweeting at random accounts on Twitter, just reminding them that we won a premiership. It might be.
Twitter's a very dangerous place after a couple of drinks, isn't it?
It sure is. I'm not on it anymore. I don't post on there anymore.
So, look, we are getting towards the end of our time together this episode, but I will just quickly ask, your time on the board ended in shortly after you took over the VFLW role. Was that connected in any way, or was your decision to leave the board in something entirely different?
No, it wasn't connected at all. So it was the end of, well, it was kind of September 2020 when actually I let the board know that I would be standing down. We were up in the hub at the time, if you remember. Well, we were coming home from the hub because it was September. I had taken a new role. I had taken a chief operating officer role that was consuming a large amount of my time that year, obviously in my professional life, not within my footy life. And we all know that the board's success and failure rides pretty much on the performance on the field. And I kind of said to my friends and my family that I never wanted to lose an election. I wanted to go out on my own terms. And I felt like...
I can understand that.
I didn't want to have the CEO call me and tell me, sorry, hand in your pass.
Yeah.
And so I made the very tough decision. There was a lot of crying for about 4 days, that it was in my best interest and the club's best interest if I let them know that I wouldn't be contesting at the next election and would be standing down. It did allow the board to put Kevin Sheedy in my seat. So congratulations or apologies, depending on how you feel. And it did allow the board to continue to move forward. But yeah, it was one of the toughest decisions I've ever made. I remember calling Paul Brasher and letting him know that I was standing down. And before I could even get the words out, I think I burst into tears on the phone, because it's such an emotional thing. And when you give so much time to a football club, yeah, that emotion can really take over when you're making those kinds of tough decisions about your own time there.
No, well, that might bring us to an end for this one, Katie. So thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate you jumping on and having a chat. It's certainly been a very interesting experience, and I'm sure all our listeners have enjoyed everything you've had to say.
Thank you. I hope this doesn't end up in the papers tomorrow.
As always, guys, please remember to like, subscribe, and tell all your friends about the Bombercast.